In politics, you're entitled to your own opinions, you're entitled to your own rhetoric, you're entitled to your own hyperbole, but you're not entitled to your own facts. That's why we have with us to begin this hour at the Republican Convention in St. Paul in our two square feet here on Radio Row, Bill Adair. He's the editor of PolitiFact.com, which is a project of Congressional Quarterly and the St. Petersburg Times. He's also the Washington Bureau Chief for that St. Pete, Florida newspaper. Bill, thanks for coming on WNYC with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we have pulled some clips from Sarah Palin and Barack Obama that you're going to help us fact check things from the last few days. So let's start with one that we were discussing a little bit last hour, but this is Governor Sarah Palin from her introductory remarks last Friday.
I signed major ethics reforms. And I appointed both Democrats and independents to serve in my administration. And I've championed reform to end the abuses of earmark spending by Congress. In fact, I told Congress thanks, but no thanks on that bridge to nowhere.
Did she tell Congress thanks but no thanks on that bridge to nowhere?
Actually, it was more like Congress told her that they didn't want it. If you remember the fuss over the bridge to nowhere, there was especially after a Parade magazine article put it on the cover, there was tremendous opposition to the bridge. And so it was really, by the time it got to her on its deathbed, Congress had withdrawn the specific money for the bridge to nowhere. Alaska had the opportunity to use that money still to build the bridge, but she opted not to. So on our truthometer on PolitiFact.com, we gave her statement a half-true, and this is what we do with the truthometer to try to help readers, listeners understand what sort of the relative truth of what these guys and other candidates are saying.
And you're giving out these cool little truth-o-meter squeeze toys.
Yes, we're big on lots of swag for PolitiFact.
Yes, and also I think when journalists get frustrated over how little truth there is in some of these statements, we can use it as one of those stress-relieving balls, right?
Exactly. That's the whole idea. And you know, our idea here is it's a chaotic election, and we really want to help people sort out the truth. And so they can come to PolitiFact.com and see what journalists who are not affiliated with either party, we're just good political journalists, have found, and whether it's true or half-true or false.
And in that spirit, we open up the phones and tell you, you know, to be fair, Bill Adair and PolitiFact.com cannot check every single fact under the sun and have not checked every single political fact under the sun. But if there are some that are relevant to you in this campaign, in the Obama-McCain campaign for President of the United States, why don't you give us a call, and maybe Bill Adair has done this work and run this to ground and has a fact check for you, okay? Something that you want to question, something that you want to clarify, you can call us up right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we are live here at the Republican Convention in St. Paul. Let's go on to a Barack Obama clip. I pulled a few here from his acceptance speech the other night. Here he talks about how the Republicans and the Democrats, in his opinion, have very different measures of what constitutes progress. Listen for the fact on family income that he states at the end of this clip.
You see, we Democrats have a very different measure of what constitutes progress in this country. We measure progress by how many people can find a job that pays the mortgage, whether you can put a little extra money away at the end of each month so you can someday watch your child receive her college diploma. We measure progress in the 23 million new jobs that were created when Bill Clinton was president, when the average American family saw its income go up $7,500 instead of go down $2,000 like it has under George Bush.
That one perked up my ears. Did American family income really go up $7,500 during the Clinton administration and down $2,000 during the 8 years of Bush?
Not quite. His overall point is right. There was, as we all know, the 90s, there was a tremendous economic boom, And indeed, incomes did go up, and they have declined slightly under Bush. But his numbers are an exaggeration, so we ended up giving this one a half true. And it has to do with the way that they calculated it versus what we thought was a more accurate way to calculate it. They used numbers that didn't reflect senior citizens, and which tended to inflate the disparity. When you look at the census numbers that we looked at, the overall numbers come in under Clinton, it went up $6,200, and under Bush, it declined $324. So not quite the disparity that he claimed, so we gave that one a half true on the Truth-O-Meter.
Let's play another Obama clip that we have kind of fact-check ourselves, or another response to an Obama claim. In the acceptance speech, he said explicitly, John McCain has no plan to make college more affordable. That one made my ears perk up because we had done an interview earlier this summer with Douglas Holtz Aiken, the chief economic advisor to Senator McCain, and I asked him specifically, what is your plan to make college more affordable? And he did have an answer, and here it is.
We have a proposal to consolidate some of the myriad tax credits that are out there so that people can more easily pull together the funds to go to college. I think the primary thing is to recognize that we have to get the control of the cost of college. That's the real issue. We could raise the Pell Grants. There's an argument to be made for that. You can raise the kinds of loans people can get. But the real problem is the underlying price keeps rising far too fast.
All right. So maybe not much of a plan.
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you flagged that one because I also marked that one as one we'd like to check, and we haven't had a chance to get to it yet because we've been so focused on Governor Palin. But I'm going to try to get your tape and listen to that because that's interesting. And I think we'll have to figure out if that's a mostly true or a half true or barely true or whatever. On PolitiFact, the nice thing about the Truth-O-Meter is it gives us these shades of gray to characterize something as not necessarily true or false, but somewhere in between.
And maybe that one is somewhere in between because my first reaction was, oh, wait a minute, we asked Holtz Aiken about whether they have a plan, and he said, yeah, we have a plan. Listening back to it now, it ain't much of a plan.
It didn't sound...
It's almost a restatement of the problem.
It didn't sound very expansive, yeah.
It just sounded like they wanted to pull together some of the myriad tax credits and consolidate something like that. And maybe Pell Grants are the way to go, but we've got to get control of the cost of education. Maybe Barack Obama was closer to the truth on that than I originally thought. Here's another Obama clip from the speech where he talks about tax breaks.
I don't believe that Senator McCain doesn't care what's going on in the lives of Americans. I just think he doesn't know. Why else would he define middle class as someone making under $5 million a year? How else could he propose hundreds of billions in tax breaks for big corporations and oil companies, but not one penny of tax relief to more than 100 million Americans?
All right, Bill Adair from PolitiFact.com. Where does that claim come from, not more than one penny, one penny of tax relief to more than 100 million Americans?
Well, that's based on the McCain tax proposal, which a big part of it is to retain the Bush tax cuts that were passed in 2001 and 2003. And then McCain has some proposals for some additional things, specifically as it relates to middle-class families, to double the exemption for dependents. We didn't actually rule on that statement the way Obama said it that time, but we have ruled on this before when it's been said in other, in slightly different wording, and we've given it a barely true. We think that Obama is not reflecting that McCain does have those two things that include a fair number of benefits for middle-class families, doubling the exemption for dependents is for many families a considerable benefit. And also the Bush tax cuts include a child tax credit that McCain would retain under his tax plan. So we've given Obama a barely true when he has said that before.
And the other number in that clip about McCain saying that $5 million constitutes the line between middle class and rich, did that come from that Rick Warren forum?
Yeah, it did, and I've got to go back and look at the transcript from that, but that's been an Obama punchline for the last week or two, and I'd like to go back to that and see.
I think I watched the forum. I think he said it as kind of a joke.
Right, and this has been one of the challenges for McCain. We're checking one today that maybe the campaign will turn around and tell us it was a joke. But McCain was talking about executive experience for Governor Palin, and he cited her experience as governor, her experience as mayor, her experience in the city council, and her experience in the PTA. And it didn't appear from the transcript that he was kidding, and so we're checking out today exactly what she did in the PTA and whether she had an executive position.
Hey, my wife was a PTA president, and it may not be the Justice Department, but that is executive experience, let me tell you.
Exactly.
You got to learn how to play politics and everything else. Mitch in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Bill Adair from PolitiFact.com. Hi, Mitch.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Bill, I want to ask you a question. I spoke to a Alaska pipeline worker recently, and he told me that Governor Palin, there was a plan to transport from the field gas down the pipeline to Valdez. But she gave the contract to TransCanada rather than an American company, and the workers in Alaska will only get to work on it for 200 miles. Then it goes to TransCanada and to Canadian workers.
Have you heard this?
No, that's a new one, Mitch. That's interesting. I will we'll keep our ears out for that one.
And Mitch, where'd you get it? Do you know your source on that?
Yeah, I got it from a man who works on the pipeline, and he works there, and then he comes down to New York occasionally.
All right, Mitch. Thanks a lot for your call. Let's go to Mike on City Island. Mike, you're on WNYC.
Hi. One of the big things Obama says he did for working between parties is supported McCain on the ethics bill. The Republicans say he betrayed McCain on the ethics bill, said he would support it, backed out at the urging of Democrat leaders, and only accepted a watered-down bill. Who's right?
We've written a lot on that one, and you're right referring to a real conflict between McCain and Obama about that. And if you go to PolitiFact, you can find that item. And I'm trying to find trying to remember exactly how we ruled on it. This has been a cornerstone of Obama's campaign to say that he's been a leader on ethics reform. And indeed, there have been some bills where he was successful in getting things inserted in the bills. But the point you make, I think, is true that Obama abandoned one big ethics bill at the end, and McCain really got after him and wrote a very nasty letter that was also given to the press that chastised Obama for playing politics. So I think you're right.
Ellen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Yes, first of all, that article about the pipeline giving away to Canada was in the New York Times a couple of days ago. But my question is this. Is it true that at one time Governor Palin was part of an Alaska secession group that wanted to secede from the Union?
We're checking on that one today. I saw that report also, and that's an interesting one. I think we're trying to keep up with all the various questions that people have about her. She's obviously a very interesting political figure now, and we know relatively little about her. So if you look at our site now, I think probably half the site now is devoted to Sarah Palin items, and probably by the end of the day, nearly all the site will be.
Ellen, thank you for your call. Any other Sarah Palin item that's new that you ran down that we didn't mention yet?
Let's see. We talked about the Bridge to Nowhere. We also gave one interesting thing on the Bridge to Nowhere. We have, in addition to the Truth-O-Meter, we have the Flip-O-Meter, where we recognize when a candidate has changed position. And we gave her a full flop on the Bridge to Nowhere because she was a supporter of the bridge at the beginning. And this is important to note. And I think we're careful not to make value judgments about flip-flops. We're not necessarily saying a flip-flop is a bad thing. That can be good leadership. But indeed, she did change positions on it. So we have that one up new today.
Jay in Jersey City, or on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Hey, I'm calling because I had heard that Sarah Palin was not really supporting Senator Ted Stevens, and then I actually read online that she not only headed up a 527 to support him as recently as 2005 before she became governor, but that she actually appeared with him in June of this year and then had the images scrubbed off her site. So, I mean, is she a supporter of Ted Stevens, who I think is, you know, under investigation like she is, and what's her position on the other senior members of the Alaska delegation who are in serious trouble?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that one. But the it's important to realize that since Stevens was indicted, that I think many Alaska Republicans have put some distance between themselves and him. And but I don't know the specifics. I would expect that she would have supported him previously. But I don't know about more recently. That's a good question.
Because this would be an interesting thing for you to follow up on, because it's certainly one of her claims that she's been very independent from the Alaska Republican Party.
Correct. And,
And she does, we are told, have a history of, you know, opposing her patron who appointed her to that major gas and oil commission when she thought he was wrong on something, so that they're trying to establish her independence.
Exactly.
In
but
a larger sense.
But at the same time, I think, especially here at the Republican convention, they're going to want to reassure people that she's also a solid Republican. So it's a fine line. This is the very same fine line that McCain himself is walking.
Get one more in here on Obama. Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I heard on talk radio 2-3 months ago, maybe, some supporter or Barack Obama himself saying that he referred to his public service experience as 20 or 25 years, something like that. And when they added up the number of years, that included his stint at Harvard. And because I know he was a community activist and then he went back to Harvard, but he included that figure. That figure had to include his years at Harvard.
Right. If you do a little volunteer work in college, does that count
right.
as
or
your years of public service?
I wonder if he was in the PTA. We've done a lot on experience. We're doing a story today, comparing Palin's experience with Obama's. If you go to our site, go to PolitiFact.com today, and you go to our search engine on the right side, and type in experience, you'll find all the things we've written about this, and you'll find a nice chart where we have broken down Obama and Obama's experience over the years when he was running against Senator Clinton.
All right.
So, we've looked at that extensively. I don't recall him making that statement, but we have looked a lot at his experience.
All right. Thanks, Gary. PTA, mark my word, very noble work. You're a volunteer. You're working with other parent volunteers and the teachers to try to get things done with the kids. Don't demean the PTA.
We're not demeaning. We're going to be fact-checking. We want to know exactly what she did in the PTA.
Bill Adair runs PolitiFact.com. It's a project of Congressional Quarterly and the St. Petersburg Times. He's also the Washington Bureau Chief for the St. Petersburg Times. Thanks a lot for doing this with us. We'll have you back and do more.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute from the Republican Convention, we continue our Swag Watch series. Who's giving out what here in St. Paul, as we looked at who gave out what in Denver, and what do they want from government? Stay tuned. Ryan Lehrer on WNYC from our 2 square feet here on Radio Row at the Republican Convention in St. Paul in the XL Energy Center. By the way, if you're following the presidential campaign, sign up for our podcast, Digesting Politics. Every week, WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein and I talk about the race over lunch and send it to you free. Digesting Politics is a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio. We just recorded a new one here in St. Paul. Sign up for free at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for that podcast. Also, you can follow us on Twitter during these 2 convention weeks. Just sign up to follow Brian Lehrer, my name, on Twitter.com, or watch for my updates through the day on the WNYC homepage. Now, as we did last week in Denver, we are on the Swag Watch in St. Paul to see which corporations and other groups are trying to grab the attention of the politicians and what they want from government. Massey Rich from the Center for Responsive Politics is with me now to discuss which businesses are here and what kinds of influence they hope to achieve. And with Hurricane Gustav disrupting the first day of the convention, maybe some of these parties didn't go on, but I suspect that they did. Hi, Massey. Welcome back to WMRC.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. You know, I talked earlier in the show about how even though they did not engage in political rhetoric from the floor as they would have on a normal first day, all the politicians, all the flacks, everybody was out here on Radio Row talking the party line, talking the issues, as I think was appropriate, actually, but as they would normally. So I have a feeling these parties went on.
I think they did, and there might have been a red kettle or something somewhere where you could drop a few dollars for the Red Cross, but for the most part, these things were planned months and months ago, and they were going to keep going. They weren't going to cancel and waste the opportunity to hobnob with decision makers, and you know they might have changed the tone just as they did in the hall yesterday. But folks are here, they're captive for 4 days, and they were going to go to these events, and the events were going to go on as scheduled, I think.
So what kind of parties were there, do you know?
Well, as a watchdog, we don't get a whole lot of invitations. If Denver is any guide, because we were there too, I think you're going to see a lot of events by the financial services industry, and you'll see that in the swag bag too. This is an industry that is very scared. They are worried that there's going to be more regulation of them because of the mortgage crisis, the economy going south, and their message seems to be at both conventions, hands off, you know, no need to over-regulate us or do anything more, Congress. We're being very responsible. They're hosting what are called these financial literacy events, which when I heard about one of them, I assumed this was a place I could go to and learn, you know, how to manage my bank account or how to make sure that my credit cards don't get out of hand. In fact, it's an opportunity for the industry to communicate to Congress and say, here's what we're doing to educate the consumer so that they're not taken advantage of by irresponsible financial services companies. And there were at least three of those in Denver, and I think they're going to go on again this week. I could not bring you from the bag the water bottle. They wouldn't let me bring it in. But it's sponsored by Visa, the credit card company, of course, and U.S. Bank. They hosted an event in Denver as well, one of these financial literacy events.
And, in fact, that's an interesting example in how many companies play both sides of the fence because they gave out that exact same water bottle at the Democratic convention.
Right, just with a donkey on it. Yeah,
with
an elephant here.
Instead of the elephant. Now, I'm getting my first look at the swag bag, and for people who don't know what that means, as the delegates arrive at the convention, they are each given a bag. It's a black canvas tote filled with goodies that are provided by various companies. As I'm looking at the tote right now, at this swag bag, I'm comparing it to the one that we saw in Denver. And there, maybe you remember, we talked about how Coca-Cola and AT&T had basically bought the front of the bag, the outside of the bag,
right,
and that the AT&T logo was bigger than the Coca-Cola logo, was about as big as the DNC logo that was also on the bag. Here, Coca-Cola also has both sides of the bag with a large logo. There's also something called the Southern Company.
Southern Company is a big utility based in the Southeast, but also in multiple states. Big utility lobbyists concerned about that there might be more regulation of their industry. Obviously, anything related to energy is going to be hot at both conventions. And the message we're seeing from Coca-Cola at both conventions is we are being a responsible recycler. All these plastic bottles that we produce, we're recycling them. And so actually, you know, in Denver, we were at the Pepsi Center, but Coke was probably the most popular there because they were handing out water, free Dasani water, iced very cold during Thursday night when everyone was waiting to get in to see Barack Obama. Here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I noticed yesterday they've got a giant hybrid truck over there carrying plenty of Coca-Cola products, and they've got big flat-screen TVs where they're promoting a video on loop of how a bottle sort of comes to life and then gets recycled. The life cycle of a bottle.
It was pretty funny in Denver because it was at the Pepsi Center seeing all this Coke and Pepsi competition, which I thought was kind of a consumer-oriented thing. But Coke buying the front of the swag bag in each place and trying to tout their recycling efforts, what's the policy agenda? What is it that they want from government?
Well, there, you know, I think it extends beyond the bottle. All these companies want to show Congress we're responsible, you know, you don't really need to be putting more rules on mandatory recycling or the content of the plastic that we make. But as it relates to a beverage company like Coca-Cola, they're going to be interested in everything from free trade to obesity in schools. I mean, there are all sorts of issues that a company that makes soft drinks and food and beverage products is going to care about. Another one that we see here in Minneapolis that working both sides is you see AT&T, you mentioned them earlier, and then Quest. In that bag, there is there's a little plastic envelope that if you have a cell phone you're getting rid of, you can mail it back to Quest and they'll recycle it.
Uh-huh.
I'd say that is definitely a theme, not just at this convention, but I think most any convention you go to these days, political or not, is corporations are green or want to tell you that they are green.
By the way, I will mention that at least at the Democratic convention, those big logos on the front of the bag were about the same size, as I said, as the DNC logo. Here you notice at the Republican convention, one side is only Southern Company and Coke,
right?
With no reference to the RNC.
On the
other side, again,
bottom.
Big Coke, big Southern Company, very small Republican National Convention logo. So maybe they don't try as hard to make a pretense of having the political
party
be independent from the corporations. You mentioned the financial services companies. In Denver, they did publish a list in the Rocky Mountain News that the DNC actually took out, thanking their sponsors. And they did it by category of how much money was given. And most of the biggest sponsors were actually communications companies, Quest, AT&T, and several others. You think here it's more financial services?
I wouldn't be surprised. It's unfortunately hard to know exactly until these things are over. The disclosure requirement for sponsorships of conventions doesn't come until 60 days after the election. That's going to take us to, after the convention, that's going to take us to a week or two before the election itself. I have a feeling people are going to have other things on their minds than, remember back in Denver and St. Paul, who sponsored those conventions? So I think any major corporation is going to be represented here in some way. In the bag, you've got UPS, AT&T, Ford Motors, Quest, as we mentioned, Visa, U.S. Bank, Travelers. I couldn't bring you the umbrella, Brian, and you need it today. It's raining outside a little bit, but you're not allowed to bring one of the key items in the bag actually into the convention itself. But that's a red umbrella sponsored by Travelers Insurance, which also has a big presence here. You can see their building just
behind
us.
Right, I'm looking now at an AT&T pin, another pin from the American Wind Energy Association. Yeah. They gave out the same thing in Denver.
Let me show you something about the AT&T. It's that blue card here.
Yeah,
so what we're looking at is a little pins are very popular conventions. People like to collect them, right? So we've got a little pin of an elephant paddling a canoe in a lake. So, we're in the land of 10,000 lakes, right? And so then it has some AT&T trivia on this card. Let me give you an example. Let's see how you do on this, Brian. Where does AT&T rank among Fortune magazine's most admired telecommunications companies in America? A, most admired, B, top 10, or C, top 25?
You tell me.
Well, the answer is A, most admired. So lots of self-promotional stuff under the guise of being a little trinket for the delegates and for the press.
And I'll throw one more at you. Captain Morgan is the official wine and spirits company of the Republican Convention. And did you know that they were officially listed as the preferred wine and spirits company of the Democratic Convention? So
Captain Morgan has been running for president almost as many times as Lyndon LaRouche. In 2000, I remember, he was running for office, and that was the only time, I'll admit this on the air, only time I was ever invited in Los Angeles to the Playboy Mansion was for Captain Morgan's launch party. So that was the kind of candidate that he was. And he's back again, same platform, same beard, and keeping the delegates happy
and
with his spiced rum.
Is that just to get drink sales among the delegates, or do they want, do they want to lower the drinking age back to 18?
Well, I think it's brand awareness, but the larger Distilled Spirits Council has events in at both conventions. In fact, they changed the title of their event. It was going to be called, I think, Spirit of the Twin Cities or something like that, and they changed it to be called Spirit of the Gulf Coast.
To get what from government?
Well, anything related to drinking age, certainly. Right now that there's this movement among college presidents to try and lower that, I don't think they've taken a position on it, but they certainly are going to be involved in the debate. And anything about, selling across state lines and trade and, all these things are so wrapped up. It's hard to know exactly what they want at this convention, but they definitely want people to be aware that they are here.
Massey Rich from the Center for Responsive Politics will do more Swag Watch later in the week. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC at the Republican Convention as we continue our Meet the Delegates series. My guest is Marianne Mora, a delegate from California. Tell me where you're from and what's great about your hometown.
I'm from Los Angeles, and I grew up in a city called El Monte, which is a big immigrant community. And I'm just very excited to be part of the democratic process. I just became a U.S. citizen last March, and this is going to be my first time voting. And I'm just so excited to be part of the delegates that will nominate John McCain.
Congratulations on your citizenship. Where did you come from?
I immigrated from Mexico when I was 8 years old.
What makes you a Republican?
You know, I just believe that, for example, that we shouldn't overspend money. Coming from an immigrant family, a lot of times, we were in a very strict budget and we never overspent. And we're always very careful that we didn't bring debt into the family. And so I respect the values of the Republican Party being fiscally conservative. I also, our family, when we came to the U.S., we realized that we needed to get an education, we needed to become professionals, and we needed to never become a dependent on the government. And so, that's why I believe that, the Republican values of helping people, empowering people so they can be self-sustainable and move their families up.
The Mexican-American population and the Hispanic population generally trending very Democratic in recent years, after the Republicans in Congress started to crack down so much on immigration. Why are you an exception?
Well, I don't think I'm really an exception. I think if you look at the Republican Party and what they've done throughout their history, they're the ones who abolished slavery. They're the ones who gave the African Americans the right to vote and the women the right to vote. And now he put a woman in the position where she can be, the vice president. And so when you look at the immigrant community and the Hispanic community, and you teach them about the Republican ideals, about being fiscally conservative, about empowering our own families and just pushing for education. Once you teach them those ideals and what the Republican Party is aligned or believes in, I tend to convert a lot of people, a lot of my community, into Republicans.
Is McCain the first Republican who you supported in this presidential election cycle? In other words, was he your first choice in the primaries?
He always was my first choice. I learned about him when I was studying political science in college, and I was just so amazed by his personality, by his history, by being a soldier and a hero, by working with both parties, the Republican and the Democratic Party, and always putting our country first. And so when he was in the primaries, I was actually very I was very disappointed when I didn't get my citizenship in time for me to vote for the primary, but I'm just so thrilled that I'm going to be able to vote for him this election.
As a newly naturalized citizen, what do you love about this country?
I love being able to talk about democracy, about being able to bring people into phone banks and talk about, the president, and talking about, freely about the different ideas, the different beliefs, the solutions to the different problems, and not feel threatened or just being ashamed of. I just love being an American and being part of this democratic process, and knowing that, I came in as a child, 8 years old, to the to the U.S., and now here I am, a delegate for the Republican Convention. This is just what America is all about, moving up, and just, it's an open dream.
And I understand you work for a nonprofit that promotes organ donation?
Yes, we encourage everyone to become organ and tissue donors. And I don't know if you know, but one person can save up to 8 lives through organ donation and enhance the lives of up to 50 through tissue donation. So I encourage everyone to sign up as organ donors and, vote this November, too.
Thank you for talking to us. Enjoy the convention.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Republican Convention in St. Paul. Sarah Vowell next. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Republican Convention. And just as Mo Rocca joined us from Denver for a unique jaundiced view of the Democratic Convention, we have Sarah Vowell coming on with us a few times this week. You know her. She's a writer. Her forthcoming book is The Wordy Shipmates, which is about the Puritans and their journey to America. You've also probably heard her on This American Life, which she's a contributor to. Or maybe you read her New York Times op-ed piece just over the weekend called Bringing Pell Grants to My Eyes. She joins us now by phone from New York. Hi, Sarah Vowell. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey there, Brian.
Let me clue our listeners in on what is going on here. As you may have heard, suddenly the beginning of my conversation with Sarah Vowell was interrupted, and I guess for whatever reason, whatever technical glitch, somewhere between St. Paul, Minnesota and New York, New York, knocked us off. We were off for a few minutes. I'm now on the phone in St. Paul with Sarah Vowell on the phone in New York, and I think you can all hear us now. And Sarah Vowell, at least you can hear me now, right?
Sure can.
Okay, that's great. So this is great. I'm holding a phone up to my ear. It's not like talking on the radio. It's just you and me, Sarah, and nobody can hear us.
Yes, and you know how we always talk on the phone about Republicans.
And Democrats and Ralph Nader and blah, blah. Do you have convention fatigue yet, or as a the civics nerd that you are, is this your moment?
Oh, yeah. No, it's hard to get tired yet because, you know, yesterday being so short. But, I'm all revved up, actually. And I've been listening to your show this morning, and, you had Gary Bauer on.
With Gary Bauer, don't you?
Well, I just remember, it's just one of those things I'll never forget was when Bauer was a candidate in the 2000 Republican primary and being at Concord High School in New Hampshire. And one of the students, a teenage girl, asked him, he was talking about his opposition to abortion rights, and she asked him point blank, if I were raped, would you expect me to give birth to my rapist baby? And he told her, yes, I would. And I've been thinking about that, especially within the context of the Sarah Palin nomination. And, I've been going back and watching her gubernatorial debates and stuff. And there was that one gubernatorial debate in Alaska in 2006 where, all this stuff about her daughter and her pregnancy, I think that is totally not worth, that we should not be talking about that. But here's one instance in which Sarah Palin herself brought up her teenage daughter's reproductive rights. And Sarah Palin said in that debate, if her teenage daughter were raped, she would, quote, choose life, which is a nice way of saying she would expect her then 14-year-old daughter, were she raped, to give birth to her rapist baby. And also, this weekend we saw Cindy McCain on George Stephanopoulos, talking about her trip to Georgia. And, she was very moved by it and saying, this is, and I quote, when you talk to a mother who says, my child was raped, it's despicable. What's going on? Well, here's what's going on in the United States. According to Amnesty International, a woman is raped every 6 minutes, a woman is battered every 15 seconds, and I do not expect rape victims to carry their rapist children to term. I'm going to go out on a limb and be against that. And I think, I guess we have to talk about Sarah Palin's gender because it certainly played into her nomination, but let's just talk about what she would do for said gender, and I am fearful. I'm fearful not just of the kind of people who would have her ear, but also should she have to, become the president and appoint one of our Supreme Court justices. This information, I'm trying to be rational. And in fact, I have a big white piece of paper with the word calm written on it to remind myself not to get upset, but I'm upset.
And I would, Sarah Vowell, my guest on WNYC.
And I would also like to, can I just also say one thing for people who are on the YouTube hunt for stuff? I would suggest finding that Joseph Biden interview on Meet the Press earlier in the year when it was the time of that ridiculously named Value Voters, convention. And he was asked, I'm not a Christian, but Joe Biden certainly is. And he was asked, how did your faith inform your policy ideas. And he said his faith is very important, and to him, the biggest sin is abuse of power. And when he was trying to illustrate that point, he didn't equate abuse of power with cozying up to lobbyists. He said it's striking a woman, striking a child. It's taking advantage of a woman or a child. And I happen to actually care more about issues having to do with how women and children are treated in this country than I care whether the person making those decisions is a woman or a man.
Let's go on to something else. How do you interpret
state? You don't want to cozy up to my rape talk?
I think, you know, you've put it out there, and, you know, as people are doing their due diligence about Sarah Palin, all these things are coming out. I mean, I talked earlier about how I think there is one relevant piece of her daughter's pregnancy to the policy agenda, which is, maybe you heard this, she answered a Phyllis Schlafly Eagle Forum questionnaire when she was running for governor in 06 on the question of teaching abstinence only or teaching Schlafly's questionnaire called explicit sex ed.
Right.
She said, no, the school should only teach abstinence only. And she even hand wrote a note that said, I would not support explicit sex ed.
In school or I guess at home. Yeah, apparently. I mean, I come from an evangelical family, and the only sex education I ever received was in school. It wasn't even brought up. It just was not discussed. I mean, it was just assumed you would wait until marriage to have sex, and nothing about the mechanics of sex, or to say anything about sexually transmitted diseases or pregnancy. None of that was discussed at home. The only place I learned those things was at school, and it was presented in like proper junior high school boring fashion. You know, it was just incredibly dry, but it just to the point, and it was the only sex education I received, and I would guess that I am not alone, you know. And clearly, teenage pregnancy exists, and one of the ways to make sure that doesn't happen is sexual education. I just feel strongly
about
that.
We're also getting word, by the way. Nuala, do you have the source for this? I'm asking my producer. We're about to get, this may have been in the Times today, that Sarah Palin herself was pregnant when she got married, for whatever it's worth.
More power to her. I mean, I honestly don't care. What I care about, I mean, if you pull back and look at it, you know, the thing that's interesting to me and important about the conventions is not the nominees. It's who's there, because these are the people who are going to have the ear of the president. These are the people who are going to be appointed by the president. And like last week, you had, you know, Nancy Pelosi. She was talking about, you know, the Democratic agenda, and one thing she said was science, 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 and whatever that means. But it indicates to me a certain interest in science, and the fact that, you know, Palin is against sexual education in school, that she's in favor of creationism being taught in school science classes. And then look at what you have going on. I mean, if you pull back even further, look at what's going on in the Gulf Coast this week. And the problems in that region are just so much more vast than, you know, evacuation. It's going to require, like, a scientific engineering effort like we've never seen in that region. And I just feel like there's a certain distrust of expertise that is, you know, the problem of the American electorate in general, but I feel like in terms of the Republican hierarchy, it's an even bigger problem.
And I don't know how to make the smooth, cool, witty transition from rape to Pell Grants.
In this American life, we would have a music cue that would do that for us.
Oh, yes. So no words would actually be necessary.
Right.
But not having that music cue, and of course it would be a perfectly ironic music cue if you were on This American Life.
Yeah.
But you wrote in your op-ed that when the Pell Grants came up at the Democratic Convention last week, you, quote, started to cry like you were watching the last 10 minutes of Brokeback Mountain instead of C-SPAN. How come?
Yeah, because I'm just one of the millions of Americans who have needed help from the federal government, and Pell Grants were just a huge really important government program in my life. I paid my own way through school. I didn't have any money. I worked 30 hours a week in a sandwich shop, and I said I worked 30 hours a week in a sandwich shop to pay for college instead of 40 because the Pell Grant allowed me just 10 extra hours a week to actually get an education and to do my homework and study. And I have paid back the federal government in income taxes. I mean, I write this. I paid them back so many, 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 many times over that it is a wonder I'm not a Republican. Like, it's just the probably smallest, like, least sexy, most boring-sounding program, but it made my life. You know, between the grants and the student loans, I could not have afforded. I mean, I could maybe have, it might have taken me 12 years and I would have finished college, but it was just such a help to me. And when Caroline Kennedy introduced her uncle, the senator, saying, you know, if you've gotten a Pell Grant, it's partly because of him. I was just so very, very grateful. And it also, in a larger sense, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, I'm kind of a Democrat, and it reminded me of
I'm getting that impression.
It reminded me of what that means, and you know, it's one thing the Republicans, one of their main, you know, talking points is we're for smaller government. Well, Democrats are for meaningful government, and I don't think, I'm not embarrassed by receiving aid from the federal government for my education. I needed the help, and I've paid them back.
By the way, we're going to run out of time here in a minute and a half, but you
said
off the air.
And jabbering on.
And I don't have, you know, okay. With that, cue the imaginary, ironic transition music.
Mm-hmm.
Music start, music
yep.
stop. You said off the air yesterday that you're not opposed to cronyism. What did you mean?
I just mean, I was talking about how McCain would appoint as his vice presidential nominee someone he'd only met once. I mean, I basically run my business, if you can call it that, like Vito Corleone. You know, I only work with the people I trust and know. I've been with the same book editor for more than 10 years, and there are things I know about the way he works and the way he thinks, and it's a real partnership. And because I know what that's like, there's no way I would just, go, like, with someone I'd only met for 15 minutes to, like, be an important part of my working life. And also, I mean, one thing, looking at all, I mean, that's what the conventions are. They're the displays of who the cronies are going to be. And last week, one of the, you know, Democratic cronies lurking about was Robert Rubin. He was talking about meeting with Obama and how it kind of reminded him of like the questions asked by Clinton before Clinton took office. And this was hugely just a relief to me because those were some
ding,
incredible...
Ding, 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 ding. That bell means our time is up.
Well,
but you'll be coming back
Robert
later
Rubin
in the week.
Is always good.
And maybe we'll get to talk a little bit about your forthcoming book, The Wordy Shipmates, next time.
People love
which
Puritans,
consistent,
Brian.
Consistent with what we talked about today. People love Puritans. Sarah Vowell, thanks a lot.
You're
Brian
welcome.
Lehrer from the Republican Convention. At